For four decades, the basic deal between big American corporations and politicians has been simple. Corporations provide campaign funds to politicians. Politicians reciprocate by lowering corporate taxes and doing whatever else corporations need to boost their profits. The deal has proven beneficial to both sides, although not to the American public. Campaign spending has soared whilst corporate taxes have shriveled. In the 1950s, corporations accounted for about 40% of federal revenues. Today, they contribute a meager 7%. Last year, more than 50 of the largest U.S. companies paid no federal income taxes at all. Many haven't paid taxes for many years. Both parties have been in on this deal, although the GOP has been the bigger player. Yet, since former U.S. President Donald Trump issued his claim about the fraudulence of the 2020 presidential election, corporate America has had a few qualms about its deal with the GOP. After the storming of the Capitol, dozens of giant corporations said they would no longer donate to the 147 Republican members of Congress who objected to the certification of Joe Biden electors on the basis of Donald Trump's claim. Then came the GOP's recent wave of restrictive state voting laws, premised on the same claim. Georgia's are among the most egregious. The chief executive of Coca-Cola, headquartered in the Peachtree State, calls those laws wrong and a step backwards. The CEO of Delta Airlines, Georgia's largest employer, says they're unacceptable. Major League Baseball decided to relocate its annual All-Star game away from home of the Atlanta Braves. These criticisms have unleashed a rare firestorm of anti-corporate Republican indignation. The Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell warns corporations of unspecified serious consequences for speaking out. Republicans are moving to revoke Major League Baseball's antitrust status. Georgia Republicans threaten to punish Delta Airlines by repealing a state tax credit for jet fuel. Florida Senator Marco Rubio asks, why are we still listening to these work corporate hypocrites on taxes, regulations, and antitrust? Why? For the same reason Willie Sutton gave when he was asked why he robbed banks. That's where the money is. McConnell told reporters that corporations should stay out of politics, but then qualified his remark by saying, I'm not talking about political contributions. Of course not. Republicans have long championed corporate speech when it comes in the form of campaign cash, just not as criticism. Talk about hypocrisy. Mitch McConnell was a top recipient of corporate money in the 2020 election cycle and has a long history of battling attempts to limit it. In 2010, he held the Supreme Court Citizens United ruling, which struck down limits on corporate political donations on the dubious grounds that corporations are people under the First Amendment of America's Constitution. Mitch McConnell said at the time, for too long, some in this country have been deprived of full participation in the political process. Hint, he wasn't referring to poor black people. It's hypocrisy squared. The growing tsunami of corporate campaign money suppresses votes indirectly by drowning out all those other voices. Republicans are in the grotesque picture of calling on corporations to continue bribing politicians as long as they don't criticize Republicans for suppressing voters directly. The hypocrisy flows in the other direction as well, though. The Delta's chief executive officer criticized GOP voter suppression by the company continues to bankroll Republicans. Its PAC contributed $1,725,000 in the 2020 election, more than the $1 million of which went to federal candidates, mostly to Republicans. Oh, and Delta Airlines hasn't paid federal taxes for many years. Don't let the spat fool you, though. The basic deal between the GOP and corporate America is still very much alive. Which is why, despite record-level corporate taxes, congressional Republicans are feigning outrage at Joe Biden's plan to have corporations pay for his $2 trillion infrastructure proposal. President Biden isn't even seeking to raise the corporate tax rate as high as it was before the Trump tax cut, yet not a single Republican will support it. A few Democrats, such as West Virginia's Joe Manchin, don't want to raise corporate taxes as high as Joe Biden does, either. Yet, almost two-thirds of Americans support the idea. The basic deal between American corporations and American politicians has been a terrible deal for America as a whole, which is why a piece of legislation entitled For the People Act, passed by the House and co-sponsored in the Senate by every Democratic senator except Joe Manchin, is so important. It would both stop states from suppressing votes and also move the country towards public financing of elections, thereby reducing politicians' dependence on corporate money. Corporations can and should bankroll much of what America needs, but they won't do that as long as corporations keep bankrolling American politicians.
Around the World with Reporters.
Nearly all British troops will be withdrawn from Afghanistan following the US President Joe Biden's announcement that US forces would leave before this year's 20th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks.
We went to Afghanistan because of a horrific attack that happened 20 years ago. That cannot explain why we should remain there in 2021.
Of 100,000 Afghan civilians, 454 British troops, and 2,488 American troops have been killed. It cost the British taxpayer over £37 billion, and the US taxpayer a whopping $2.4 trillion. It's lasted longer than both world wars combined, and ranks as the US's longest ever war. But what's actually been achieved?
The Taliban, which they fought so hard to oust, are poised to return to power and control most of the country. Takfiri terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda are still present, and new groups like Daesh have emerged. Moreover, Afghanistan now accounts for 93% of the world's illicit heroin supply, with heroin production reaching its record levels in 2017. We spoke to Lindsay German, who was at the forefront of the British anti-war movement and one of the leading voices making the case against the UK joining the US's war effort in 2001.
We argued back in September 2001, which, as you say, is now 20 years ago, that this war in Afghanistan would not deal with terrorism, would not solve the problems that were highlighted by 9/11, but would bring increasing misery to the people of Afghanistan.
The Speaker of the Afghan Parliament, Mir Rahman Rahmani, has warned that the withdrawal of foreign forces in the current circumstances will lead to a civil war, with many arguing the incumbent government is simply not strong enough to maintain power.
lots of people assume that when the troops go, this will be the beginning of the end, at least for the existing government, because it very much depended on outside support in order to keep going. So, yeah, this war, I think if you want to sum it up, this is 20 years. What were those 20 years for?
Afghanistan has earned itself the nickname the Graveyard of Empires due to the failure of empire after empire, nation after nation, to successfully occupy and pacify the people. Many will question why it took the US and the UK so long to accept the inevitable, that this was a war they simply could not win. Ahmed Kabbalah, London.
For European Muslim women, wearing a niqab is no easy decision, with Islamophobic hate at epidemic levels and face covering bans coming into force. Choosing to cover up can land a woman with hefty fines, abuse, or physical harm.
With so much hostility aimed at the Islamic face veil, it is truly astonishing that any woman would continue to embrace the practice. Yet, despite these risks, many niqabis living in the West choose to continue to remain covered. This Ramadan, I decided to find out why.
V spoke to several niqabi sisters, including Zainab from Switzerland, the most recent country to ban the niqab.
For me, it's a worship service act for Allah. Nobody told me you have to wear the niqab right now. It's my free decision. It's a protection for me, and it's a free decision for my own to wear the niqab. It's a thing between me and Allah.
Critics claim the niqab holds women back, but renowned author Naima B. Robert rebuked these claims.
I think that it is really a case of the media and those behind the media need that myth of the oppressed Muslim woman in order to justify their attitudes towards Muslims in general, their hostile attitudes. It's very easy to demonize Muslims. It's very easy to enact legislation, populist legislation against Muslims, and to stoke hatred of Muslims because, hey, everyone's going to jump on board with that. All the parties will converge and agree on this. But what about the real things that are happening in those societies, whether it's unemployment, whether it's depression, all of the issues that are actually destroying their societies? Women in niqab are not that thing. Women wearing niqab in Switzerland or Holland or France are not the problem in your society. And we're not the problem with regards to any of the external threats either. We're not the terrorists. We are not the sleeper cells. We're just not. That's the fact of it.
It's true that not all Muslims believe in wearing a niqab. However, the niqabis warn that once Europe has finished with them, the hijab and other Islamic principles could be the new target. Robert Carter, London.
A tribunal in Burkina Faso has decided to open a trial against Blaise Compaoré. He is accused of having organized in 1987 the putsch against Thomas Sankara and his killing. Recent interrogations revealed that France was directly involved in the putsch and maybe more. Thomas Sankara, who was called the Che Guevara of Africa, led in the 80s a popular revolution in Burkina Faso that eradicated the famine in 4 years' time and made the country self-sufficient on food production. He also called all the African leaders to suspend the debt payment to the World Bank and the IMF. Months later, he was killed. Decades after the murder of Thomas Sankara, Burkina-based judges have interrogated former members of the murder commando like Gilbert Diendéré. Journalists had access to the minutes of the report. It reveals the presence of French personnel just after the assassination.
At least 4 or 5 testimonies of Burkinabe militaries declared that French persons were present the day after the assassination in order to clean things up. That means they eliminated telephone conversations that could accuse the coup leaders. That does not mean that France was directly involved in the assassination of Thomas Sankara, but it indicates that French persons came to Burkina Faso to help Blaise Compaoré to clean things up.
Blaise Compaoré will soon become Paris's main guy in the region. The overthrow of Sankara in 1987 was not possible without the green light of Ivory Coast and the explicit support of Paris, in particular of Jacques Chirac, who was then Prime Minister. Chirac really disliked Thomas Sankara. Was France also complicit in the killing of Thomas Sankara? To answer that question, all the classified archives have to be opened.
The full opening of archives would allow to clarify the exact conditions of the putsch against Thomas Sankara. The judges in Burkina Faso were very surprised that no documents sent from France had the stamp classified military secret or top secret.
In 2017, French President Macron promised in Burkina Faso to declassify all the archives concerning the assassination of Thomas Sankara, but only diplomatic and other public documents have been sent. Experts suspect that French military might prevent the opening of all the archives because that could reveal the truth about Operation Barkhane. France is more and more criticized in Mali, and the anti-French sentiment in Burkina Faso is also growing. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
United States President Joe Biden has made a deal with Mexico, Guatemala, and Honduras to increase border security in order to prevent refugees from reaching the U.S. border. The leaders of Mexico and Guatemala criticized Biden for having initially sent compassionate messages that encouraged refugees to try and reunite with their families, only to find often brutal conditions and deplorable treatment at the U.S. border. Per capita, the U.S. accepts only a tiny amount of asylum seekers, and yet immigration appears to be the most talked about issue today. What's seemingly never discussed in the mainstream media is how U.S. foreign policy is so often the direct cause of the political instability and economic dysfunction which produces these regular refugee crises.
It feels odd to say even foreign policy, considering how deeply involved the U.S. has been in the development of Latin America, especially Central America, where a lot of these, you know, refugees and migrants are coming from. And this, you know, 100-year-long history is never addressed in the media. The wars in the 80s that Reagan waged against, you know, progressive governments and movements in Central America are never discussed. And even, like, extremely recent history, like the 2008 overthrow of the government in Honduras or the disputed 2017 election, are not discussed. And that is just recent history. It doesn't delve into, you know, the long history of colonialism, the Monroe Doctrine. People may have heard this in school, but they don't really understand what it means. It means the U.S. extracting resources from these countries. So it's no wonder that people would want to go from the areas the U.S. impoverished to the U.S., which has that wealth now.
Domestically, Republicans are being accused of fear-mongering about immigrants, while Democrats are being accused of using foreign immigration to distract from the unprecedented economic and health crises. The right to asylum is protected in international and U.S. law, but Biden appears to be following the same militaristic approach as his controversial predecessor, which many repeatedly called inhumane. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Young black people have been hardest hit by unemployment during the pandemic, new research indicates. Over the past year, the UK jobless rate for young black people rose by more than a third to 35%, according to the Resolution Foundation think tank. That compared with a rate of 13% for young white people and a rate of 24% for young people of Asian descent. By the end of the year, unemployment among young black graduates had risen to 34%, up from 22% before the pandemic.
I graduated last year with a business degree, and I know COVID has, you know, really impacted the job market and all that stuff. But just being a black person as well, on top of that, it just makes things a lot harder.
Even if a black person has a degree and has just left university, they're finding it hugely difficult to get a job. And I think that's proof positive that Britain is a systemically racist society. Even in the year of 2021, we're seeing that time and time again, that the life chances, the opportunities available to black people are much worse than those available to the white population.
The findings follow the government's recent controversial report into race relations in British society, which claimed the UK does not suffer from institutional racism and should be a model for other white majority nations. Yet the research from the Resolution Foundation, along with other racial disparity statistics, paints a very different picture, which critics argue the government's report failed to acknowledge.
In the British capital, London, young black males were 19 times more likely to be stopped and searched than the general population, and were 28 times more likely to be stopped on suspicion of carrying weapons than the general population. Black people were 6.5 times more likely to be fined than white people for breaking COVID-19 regulations, and more than 4 times more likely to die from COVID-19 than white people.
Black Britons, African Caribbeans and Asians face systemic racism. They're 9 times more likely to be stopped and searched by the police. As women, 3 times more likely to die in childbirth. Were 60% of the doctors and nurses and health frontline workers who died at the very beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic. And for the government's report to say that institutional racism doesn't exist is just a kick in the teeth.
Foundation's findings expose that COVID had widened already existing gaps between the UK's ethnic groups, and they've urged for special efforts to ensure that young people from hard-hit ethnic backgrounds had access to quality education, training options, and where needed, financial support for full-time study. But many will feel the government may not have the remedy for this issue while they refuse to accept the diagnosis, systemic racism. Ahmed Cabello, London.
As the fasting month of Ramadan arrives, Afghans happily welcome it with honour and pride. In the meantime, poverty and low control over prices in the market by the government are major problems that poor families are facing. That is why they call on responsible bodies to take strict measures in order to control the market during the holy month.
We want businesses to think about difficulties of the poor during the fasting month of Ramadan. Government bodies also need to fully control food prices and prevent sharp price hikes during Ramadan to help poor families and individuals.
Fasting Afghans also see this month as an opportunity for not only to strengthen their bonds with God, but also to further help and support the underprivileged in society. That is one of the fundamental teachings of Islam.
This is a religious and humanitarian responsibility of every single Muslim to help poor people, especially orphans and widows who have no breadwinner, and Ramadan creates opportunities for us to fulfill our responsibility in this regard.
Besides other challenges, the COVID-19 pandemic in Afghanistan is also a problem on the way of fasting Afghans. This is because they religiously organize big gatherings during the holy month each year. The continuation of terrorist attacks and bombings during the fasting month of Ramadan is one of the other headaches for Afghans, especially for military forces who are either in the front lines or inside their posts and bases across the country. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi announces Iran's decision to increase the level of uranium enrichment from 20 to 60% and to install an additional 1,000 centrifuges at its Natanz facility, the target of a recent act of sabotage. Araghchi broke the news upon arriving in Vienna for another joint commission meeting aimed at reviving the nuclear deal. He said the International Atomic Energy Agency has been informed.
We just sent a new letter to the agency saying that we would start from tomorrow enrichment up to 60%. And that is for Iran needs in to produce certain radio isotopes needed for certain medical treatments.
Araghchi said the damaged centrifuges in Natanz would be replaced by more advanced ones, and that things would go back to normal there in the coming weeks. Signatories of the nuclear deal are expected to meet in Vienna on Thursday as negotiations continue. Iran insists that all US sanctions should be lifted and their removal verified before it goes back to full compliance.
We believe that this round of negotiations is the time for the US to present the list. And I hope that I can go back to Tehran with the list of sanctions, which should be lifted. Otherwise, I don't believe we can continue like this. Otherwise, it would be a waste of time, actually. So let's see.
Informal discussions have already begun here with the hope of reaching an agreement on the list of U.S. sanctions that need to be lifted, after which Iran says it will discuss the verification process. Homa Lesgi, Vienna.
Lining up for donated clothes and a warm meal. More than 100 men who have survived Western-backed wars in the Middle East and Africa and a death-defying journey to get to the UK. A former bank employee, Keenan, is a Syrian asylum seeker living in temporary accommodation in the Welsh city of Cardiff.
I didn't leave my country in the first 5 years of the war. I left after 8 years and a half. I tried and did my level best to stay in my home country and not being a refugee. Refugee is not a good thing to be. It's not an option.
Before Cardiff, this father of one and his fellow asylum seekers had been housed in a dilapidated army barracks in the coastal village of Penali. Economics graduate Fateh worked as a risk analyst in his home country.
When I first came here, I had no idea about military camps, but we put into camps and it was a horrible experience.
The UK government says it takes the well-being of asylum seekers extremely seriously, and any abuse is completely unacceptable. But the organizer of the welcoming event in Cardiff, who has also spent a lifetime combating racism, believes the government has failed to live up to its obligation.
Without a shadow of a doubt, they failed. They failed miserably. Some of the initial accommodation is abysmal. We have seen people rehoused in shared houses where they have to share one bathroom, one kitchen with dangerous kitchen facilities.
After surviving the dangerous journey to Europe, they were greeted with this: far-right protests in Dover last year.
Here in Cardiff today, an act of kindness and compassion towards asylum seekers who come here from far and wide, from the Middle East and Africa, among them doctors and engineers. Contrast this with the kind of hostility and hate they have been receiving from some people who think that their country is under invasion by irregular immigrants.
One of the consequences of coronavirus has meant the country's already overloaded asylum application system has ground to a halt, leaving these men living a life of wait and see.
Many people have been living here in limbo, not knowing when their asylum process is going to be progressed. And of course you have some people here who are separated from their family. They have family.
Britain remains the fifth most favorite European destination for refugees and asylum seekers, way behind Germany, France, Spain, and Greece. Keenan and other refugees and asylum seekers have survived war and the perilous voyage here, but their journey to call it their new home is yet to end. Saeed Puriza, London.
While millions of Yemenis are suffering from a severe fuel shortage due to Saudi Arabia's continued seizure of oil ships, an Emirati oil tanker named Saga has arrived at Bir Ali port in Shabwa in eastern Yemen to transport 115,000 tons of Yemeni crude oil to the UAE.
Oil smuggling carried out by the Saudi-led coalition in southern and eastern provinces has cost Yemen more than $7 billion over the past 2 years. Annually, more than 14 million barrels of crude oil are being smuggled illegally through several ports in Shabwa province, which is under the control of Saudi Arabia.
Meanwhile, Yemen's petroleum company says another oil tanker named Apolitaris is on its way to Deba port in Al Mukalla to move more than 300,000 tons of oil to an unknown destination.
Yemen is being systematically plundered by Saudi Arabia. An estimated $145 million of oil income is being looted monthly. Recently, an Emirati ship arrived at Shaba port to plunder 1 million barrels of crude oil, and there is another ship coming from China to transport over 2 million barrels of crude oil.
Yemenis have been suffering from a harsh shortage of fuel due to the continued detention of 10 petrol ships by Saudi Arabia. While the vessels are inspected and authorized by the UN through verification and inspection mechanism.
Yemenis say plundering their oil is an illegal act that reveals the real reasons for the years-long war on their country by Saudi Arabia and its allies. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Attacks on Muslim women and Muslims in public spaces are already rampant in France. The idea of uniformed French police demanding Muslims in the street proved their right to wear the hijab, and the notion that French authorities could legally have the power to ambush women and girls and adjudicate on what they can or cannot wear is an utterly terrifying prospect. We now present you an article written by Richard Sudan, a journalist, writer, and television reporter, under the heading, Britain and France Claim They Are Fair Societies. Anti-Muslim and Anti-Black Racism Says Otherwise. Please stay with us for more of Richard Sudan's article. Both the United Kingdom and France love to portray themselves as being liberal, welcoming, open democracies grounded in values of respect and tolerance, with freedom of speech treasured as being sacrosanct. But the reality in both countries, and the lived experience for millions of people within them, is a far cry from the image that these two nations offer the world. In the United Kingdom, for example, the recent government-backed report claiming that the United Kingdom is not institutionally racist, though anticipated, has continued to anger many people in the aftermath of its publication. The indignation is building by the day, and is certainly not subsiding anytime soon. And this is because we see constant examples of inherent racism and bias in Britain in virtually every sphere of life imaginable. Those highlighting racism are often politely encouraged to remain silent, unsurprisingly, by those who have never experienced racism. But the recent report and ultimately public relations exercise by the United Kingdom simply cannot reconcile and does not square with the truth of life in Britain and many marginalized communities. We are told that we should bask in gratitude about the progress towards racial equality that has been made over the years. Such progress, of course, when it happens, is only ever actually achieved because of the long and arduous hard-fought battles by those who tirelessly campaign and fight for justice. Real progress, of course, and change does not simply occur because the system is virtuous or willing to relinquish one iota of power unless it is forced to do so. It happens because of demands of those who will not accept injustice. And one such example arguably took place recently in a school in London, the nation's capital. At the Pimlico Academy in Westminster, students staged a mass protest and walkout at the school's proposed policies. The head teacher at the Pimlico Academy in Westminster, Daniel Smith, had last year set new uniform rules which stated that hijabs worn by Muslim students should not be too colourful, and that hairstyles that block the view of others would not be allowed. Students argued that the measures to be enforced for those wearing the hijab and the haircut rule would punish Muslims and also black students with natural afros, therefore resulting in the targeting, humiliation and unfair discrimination against those from minority faiths and cultures. Regarding the hijab ban, it was said to be acceptable for students to wear other items of clothing in whatever style and colour they wished, but not the hijab. Ultimately, the head teacher, under pressure, reversed the school's policies after backlash from students and those among the public who were supportive after the campaign gained national headlines. The school had also been heavily criticized for apparently excluding the significance of Black History and Black Lives Matter protests in its classrooms, as well as times ignoring concerns over the placement of the Union Jack flag at the school. This flag, for many people, due to Britain's history of colonialism, is highly offensive. But the example of Pimlico Academy is by no means an anomaly. And other schools, such as Batley Grammar School very recently in Yorkshire, have been accused of using insulting caricatures of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, during lessons, going far beyond the boundaries of reasonable discussion about faith, whilst needlessly insulting Muslim students, often in areas of the country where far-right racism is rearing its ugly head. Similarly, for black communities, there are many instances where students, have seen their faith targeted by discriminatory policies in schools. This was the case for Chikezia Flanders, a former student at Fulham Boys' School. Flanders was demanded to cut off his dreadlocks in order to continue attending the school, outraging his family and community. Dreadlocks are an integral part of the Rastafarian faith for those that follow it, and despite not returning to the school, Flanders and his family eventually won a legal battle against the school due to their treatment of him. And now we're learning that France, another country with serious issues of racism and a shameful colonial history like Britain, which also paints itself as being progressive, has voted to ban the wearing of the hijab for those under the age of 18. This amounts to state-backed Islamophobia, plain and simple, which, if indeed does become law, will not only oppress a minority community already pushed to the margins of society by long-standing and systematic racism, but will serve as a further green light to violent racism on the streets. Attacks on Muslim women and Muslims in public places already rampant in France. The idea of uniformed French police demanding Muslims in the street prove their right to wear the hijab, and the notion that French authorities could legally have the power to ambush women and girls and audiences on what they can or cannot wear is an utterly terrifying prospect. For a country once occupied by fascists during the Second World War, it seems that France has learned nothing about the danger of racist thugs in uniform having the power to terrify people on the street, or worse. Britain was recently argued to be supposedly an example of a model for other majority white nations to follow when it comes to the notion of racial equality. The so-called revolutionary history of France is often romantically heralded and evoked in the history books and throughout the world as a shining example of liberty. But the descendants of the communities of countries once colonized by both Britain and France, now living in Britain and France, have a very different story to tell. There is far more of a distance to travel to achieve full equality in both countries when compared to any progress that might actually have taken place. France taking steps to make yet more Islamophobic laws is a grave hypocrisy. Britain claiming the moral high ground as an example of a nation claiming to embrace racial justice following the recent government-backed report is simply absurd. Many would argue that both countries in many aspects are moving backwards when it comes to issues of racism, with anti-Muslim and anti-black prejudice continuing to be a blight in both countries, with dangerous nationalism more and more finding its way into the political center ground. Until this situation is acknowledged and ultimately reversed, neither Britain nor France has a right to permeate the Orwellian myth that they are free from institutional racism or resemble anything remotely close to true free and fair societies. While they continue to clamp down on non-white communities, such suggestions are nothing short of deliberate misleading propaganda with a particularly dangerous historical precedent, certainly when it comes to Europe.
Africa Today.
Hundreds of Ethiopian immigrants landed in Tel Aviv in March as part of an aggressive move by the Israeli regime to change the demographics of the occupied territories and further push Palestinians out of their land. These Ethiopians face constant discrimination and racism in Israel. An Ethiopian immigrant in the occupied territories speaks out here during an anti-racism protest. Let's take a listen.
We can tell that no one sees us. No one investigates these issues deeply. They always sweep this issue under the carpet.
Hello and a warm welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today, which is focusing on the recent immigration of Ethiopian Jews to Israel and the discrimination they face in the occupied territories. Now, in the second segment of our program, we shall go to the Congo Basin and have a look at the dangers the rainforest in this region is facing. So join us till the end of our show.
Ethiopian Jews face racism in Israel. Some 300 Ethiopian immigrants landed in Tel Aviv in mid-March as part of a colonial plan by the Israeli regime to bring Ethiopian Jewish community to the occupied territories. They were the last of 2,000 Ethiopian immigrants to arrive in an operation which began last December. Nearly 150,000 Ethiopian Jews now live in Israel. Many arrived in a secret immigration operation that took place in the mid-1980s and early 1990s. Most of these Ethiopian Jews face racism in their daily lives and experience institutional discrimination at every level. Even their Jewishness is doubted. This comes as no surprise, as Israel is an apartheid regime.
In 2019, a trigger-happy Israeli policeman shot dead Solomon Teka, a teenager of Ethiopian descent, sparking nationwide protests. One of the protesters expresses fear of daily racist attacks.
I have small kids. This is enough. It's not nice. I'm always worried about my son until I see him with my own eyes when he comes home. Aren't we also humans?
The policeman who shot dead Teka was recently allowed to resume duty. The family of Teka voiced shock and astonishment over his return.
Such incidents are clear evidence that the racist Israeli regime does not really care about Ethiopian Jews, who are being used as part of its long-term strategy to change the demographic makeup of the occupied territories. This plan also includes constructing illegal settlements, destroying historical sites, and expelling the local Palestinian population.
For more on this subject, we contacted Dr. Louis Gordon, the founder of the Center for Afro-Jewish Studies. He's also a professor and head of the Department of Philosophy at the University of Connecticut. Thanks a lot, Dr. Gordon, for your time. Now, as we know, Ethiopian Jews have lived in Ethiopia for centuries. Now, why is the Israeli regime now encouraging them to immigrate to the occupied territories?
You see, although the initial issue was around Jewish Ethiopian refugees, which is part of the Operation Moses situation, if you look at Wings of Dove, this is where you have an unabashedly right-wing government of Israel, and the purposes there are a little different, and the numbers are not as large. So the thing to bear in mind is that there are Ethiopian Jews all over the world. There are prominent intellectuals, prominent activists, all the way down to the working class individual, from the cab driver to the person in the store, and there are varieties of reasons. What's unfortunate is their cause has been captured by the by the conflicts that are really focused more in Israel. But for Ethiopian Jews, for instance, I'm of a variety of Jewish descent, from Mizrahi, from Palestine and Jerusalem, to Sephardic Jews, but also part of my ancestry's Ethiopian Jews. And these are Jews who were in Jamaica. So not all Jews in the world are Jews who want to go to Israel.
Thanks for that, Mr. Gordon, and stay tuned for more.
Ethiopians have long complained about unfair treatment and police violence in Israel and say they're treated as third-class citizens. Bags of blood donated by Ethiopian Jews were found dumped by Israel in 1996. The discovery led to protests and riots in Israel. An Ethiopian demonstrating against discrimination and Israeli police brutality could not mince his words.
I have lots of friends who the police have hit and targeted with tasers. Yesterday it was him, tomorrow it could be me, and the day after it could be my brother or a friend. Why do they do this? Because they're racists.
Ethiopian Jews are now facing discrimination in Israel. Now, do you think they would have been better off staying in Ethiopia?
The thing we have to deal with is that not only are there black Jews everywhere, but we face ongoing struggles even in Israel. Because, I mean, we can't pretend. I mean, there is racism in Israel. And I should add that the Israeli left, as do the U.S. left, join in protest against the discrimination. But the fact is, they're protesting because the discrimination exists, and especially when you talk about the police. But as we know, a big problem with black people in countries that are not predominantly black is this problem of state representatives of violence. And that's why I bring up the police, although if you bring up the Israeli case, you'll also have to bring up the military.
The Israeli regime has also illegally attempted to control the birth rate among Ethiopian immigrants. This racist regime admitted it gave Ethiopian Jewish immigrants birth control injections without their knowledge or consent. Now, why did the Israeli regime forcibly inject Ethiopian women immigrants with birth control shots? This is clearly a criminal move.
The fact of Israeli misdeeds on Ethiopian Jews has been known for decades. Not only in terms of what they're doing with birth control, but the thing is, what's very tricky is an issue that Ethiopian Jews face also when they migrate, not only in Israel, in terms of their numbers.
The Israeli regime also seeks strategic relationships with African governments, while the marginalization of Africans persists within the occupied territories. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is pursuing a plan to deport thousands of African migrants in his racist anti-migrant campaign. He called these African migrants infiltrators. Netanyahu has issued racist remarks against African migrants. What motivates Ethiopian Jews to migrate to the occupied territories while they clearly know they will face racial discrimination?
We're talking also about a right-wing government. I don't know any right-wing governments that are not racist. It's the same kind of language we had with Trump, as an example. Why would some people migrate to a right-wing country that is going to treat them in dehumanizing ways? Well, their motivation is connected to their specific situations. In some cases, they have family members there. In some cases, it just so happens the opportunity came there. And in other cases, they vary. But in most cases, it's desperation.
Dr. Gordon there says that the immigration of Ethiopian Jews to territories occupied by Israel is out of desperation. Quite clearly, this is a case of jumping out of the frying pan into the fire. Now, before we wind up our interview, let's watch remarks by a high-ranking Israeli regime diplomat on Ethiopian Jews.
Many of them actually converted, or their parents converted to Christianity for various reasons. And now they are. They wish to return to be part of the Jewish people. They are not considered as Jews, so they already live as Jews, but officially they are not yet converted, so they are not yet Jews.
Now, the Israeli regime has been airlifting Ethiopian Jews in pursuit of its settler colonial project in the occupied Palestinian territories, but says they are not Jewish enough. What's your take?
The people who have the power, who are hegemonic, are always saying that the people who don't have the power are not authentically who they are. But Ethiopian Jews know they're Jewish people. And Ethiopian Jews, and not only they, but many Jews I've met across the world, they know who they are. And in the end, if there's a state that's not going to recognize them, then look, they'll live elsewhere.
Thanks a lot for your insight, Dr. Gordon. Now, when we come back after a short break, we'll talk about dangers facing the Congo rainforests.
rainforest in peril.
The Congo Basin Forest is the world's second largest tropical rainforest, covering approximately 170 million hectares, that is more than four times the size of Germany. This forest is one of the most important places in the world to help reduce the effects of climate change. Now, Congo Basin Forest spans six countries, that is Cameroon, the Central African Republic, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Gabon, Equatorial Guinea, and the Republic of Congo. The Congo rainforest is also of critical importance to local populations.
So here we've got a peat sample from 2.5 meters to 3 meters deep. So it's a surprise to see such depths here. We suggest that possibly after some more exploration, we might have to revise our estimates of how much carbon is stored in this basin, in the central Congo basin, upwards a little bit.
In recent years, the rate of deforestation in the Congo Basin forest has increased at an alarming rate. According to Greenpeace Africa, illegal and unsustainable logging, compounded by weak forest management, has resulted in the average loss of 374,000 hectares per year. That's quite a massive loss. A community leader in the Democratic Republic of Congo laments here the loss of the forest cover in his village.
Les forestiers venaient encore ici chez nous. Moi, je dirais personnellement non. Je n'aurais pas signé parce que j'ai vécu, j'ai eu l'expérience par rapport à l'autre.
For an incisive analysis on what danger the Congo Basin faces due to deforestation, we are joined by Nimo Basse. He's an environmental activist, author, and director of Health of Mother Earth Foundation. Thanks a lot, sir, for your time. Now, how massive is the destruction of the Congo Basin rainforest?
The Congo Basin rainforest covers a wide area in a number of countries in the heart of Africa. It's the second largest tropical primary rainforest in the world. Compared to the rest of deforestation in other parts of the world, this used to be fairly low, especially when you compare to the deforestation in the Amazon. But of late, the rate of deforestation has been increasing, and this is very worrisome.
Thanks for that, Mr. Bassey.